Freya, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm David Byrd reporting Hillary Clinton has accepted the Democratic Party's nomination for president. Clinton officially accepted the nomination on the final night of the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
And so, my friends, it is with humility, determination, and boundless confidence in America's promise that I accept your nomination for President of the United States.
Clinton told the cheering crowd that as president, she wants to empower all Americans to live better lives with more opportunity, good jobs, and rising wages. The former Secretary of State also criticized Republican nominee Donald Trump as being too unstable and too inexperienced to be president.
If you dare, imagine him in the Oval Office facing a real crisis. A man you can bait with a tweet is not a man we can trust with nuclear weapons.
The former Secretary of State also reached out to supporters of her chief rival, Bernie Sanders, saying the country needs their enthusiasm and their passion. Clinton is the first female candidate to be selected as a major party's nominee in the history of the United States. U.S. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump campaigned in Iowa Thursday and said a lot of lies were being told about him at the Democratic convention. At a campaign rally, Trump criticized Democrats for not talking about extremism or laying out a plan to aid the economy. He also said earlier Thursday he was sarcastic when he encouraged Russia to hack Hillary Clinton's email service to find deleted emails. This is VOA News. Russia's defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, says that four corridors will be set up to permit civilians and unarmed fighters to leave the now besieged rebel-held eastern districts of Aleppo, Syria. The Syrian government, meanwhile, is promising amnesty to fighters who surrender within 3 months. The city has been surrounded and nearly 300,000 people are trapped inside it. As Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, the UN Special Envoy for Syria says he is seriously concerned about the welfare of the people of Aleppo.
News of the Russian military proposal came while the UN Special Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, was attending a weekly meeting of the Humanitarian Access Task Force. De Mistura says he and his colleagues were taken by surprise.
It is premature for me and others to actually make any comments until we have further details and on what has been and is the Russian proposal or initiative.
Under the Russian proposal, civilians reportedly will be allowed to leave Aleppo through three routes and rebels through a fourth. An estimated 300,000 people are trapped in Aleppo. Government forces are encircling the city, making it impossible for aid agencies to bring in food, medicine, and other essential supplies. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Syrian branch of Al-Qaeda, the Al-Nusra Front, announced Thursday it was breaking ties with the global terror network. In a video, its leader, Abu Muhammad al-Julani, said the organization decided to stop operating under the banner of al-Nusra and to set up a new front called Jabhat Fateh al-Sham. Here in Washington, White House spokesman Josh Earnest says the Obama administration is still committed to fighting extremists, despite news that the group was cutting its ties with al-Qaeda.
President Obama, the rest of the Obama administration, and our military actions have been focused on and directed against a variety of extremist groups inside of Syria, including both ISIL and the Nusra Front.
Analysts said al-Nusra hopes to rebrand and defend itself as it faces increased pressure after Washington and Moscow agreed to step up joint efforts against jihadist groups. Turkey's Supreme Military Council gathered Thursday in a hastily planned meeting to replace more than 2,400 military personnel dismissed on Wednesday. Turkey's military leaders have to fill vacancies for 149 generals and admirals, nearly half of its contingent. The move comes as part of a wider purge of government officials and academic leaders following an attempted coup, which left nearly 300 people dead. For more, log on to our website, voanews.com. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today's Friday, July 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Hillary Clinton has made history by becoming the first woman presidential candidate of a major U.S. political party.
And so, my friends, it is with humility, determination, and boundless confidence in America's promise that I accept your nomination for President of the United States.
We will also talk live with VOA's Vincent Mankori, who is covering the Democratic Party convention in Philadelphia. Human Rights Watch says Senegal's government must do more to protect children from abuse by their Quranic school teachers. And Malawi kickstarts the distribution of food to starving communities.
We have to work hard, smart, to avoid losing people's lives. The mistake we make here, somebody is going to lose their life.
Saulos Chiliman is Malawi's vice president. Ghana's Supreme Court sentences three journalists for contempt. Zimbabwe police arrest the Secretary General of the War Veterans Association. And South Sudan's military court-martials 14 SPLA soldiers for killing civilians and looting. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton last night formally accepted the Democratic Party's nomination for the 2016 presidential election. She becomes the first woman to be nominated by a major political party in the 238-year history of the United States. In her acceptance speech, Mrs. Clinton called on Americans to stand together just as their founding fathers did, because together the country is stronger.
Our founders embraced the enduring truth that we are stronger together. Now America is once again at a moment of reckoning. Powerful forces are threatening to pull us apart. Bonds of trust and respect are fraying. And just as with our founders, there are no guarantees. It truly is up to us. We have to decide whether we will all work together so we can all rise together.
Mrs. Clinton also credited her primary election challenger, Senator Bernie Sanders, for bringing young people into the Democratic Party.
I want to thank Bernie Sanders. Americans, particularly the young people who threw their hearts and souls into our primary. You put economic and social justice issues front and center where they belong. And to all of your supporters here and around the country, I want you to know I've heard you. Your cause is our cause.
That was Democratic Party presidential candidate Hillary Clinton speaking Thursday night after formally accepting her party's nomination. Joining us now from Philadelphia is VOA's Vincent Mankori, who has been covering the Democratic Party convention. Good morning to you, Vincent.
Good morning, James.
Well, thank you again for joining us. How do you think Mrs. Clinton's speech was received by the delegates and overall the American people?
You know, right here, the arena, you could see that the delegates were extremely delighted just to listen to Hillary Clinton with the standing ovations or the cheers here. Everybody seemed to be happy. Across the nation, of course, you could tell, you can imagine that many people were really happy to listen to Hillary Clinton talk about herself in perhaps a different way than she has had before. She was reintroducing herself to the American population or the American public, not so much for what they know about her as the Secretary of State or what she was, the First Lady, but so much as a person, the human being that she is, the woman that she is, and a person that they could trust to lead them at this time in history.
Well, along those lines, you know, coming into the Democratic Party convention, most Americans view Mrs. Clinton unfavorably. And so do you think the convention might help to change some minds about her favorability?
It looks likely that the convention has helped a great deal to change people's minds about her. Throughout the days of this convention, the speaker after speaker have focused so much on her as a person. And particularly if you think about her husband, the speech he gave, her daughter Chelsea introduced her, the video that was used to introduce her before she came on stage, where, among others, President Obama speaks about her. She was humanized. She was brought to the public as an amazing individual, a great wife, or a great woman, a great mother, but a person who has devoted all her life to serving particularly the children of this country, and especially the children who are disadvantaged due to, disabilities or handicapped issues and poverty. She was reintroduced to the eyes of Americans in a way that if, you know, somebody sits and listens a little differently, they would embrace her than the person that they have known participating in public service. And as she said, she values more of the service than the public. And she was trying to say, I want you to know me as a person who is more concerned about serving rather than just being known publicly for what I do.
Vincent, you were fortunate to attend both the Republican Party convention in Cleveland and now the Democratic Party convention. How would you compare Mrs. Clinton's acceptance speech to that of her opponent and Republican Party presidential candidate Donald Trump?
Donald Trump made a speech about himself. It was about this Superman who is coming to save Americans from a declining economy, from danger, from a country that is kind of in chaos. It was, of course, a celebration of hope, of doom and gloom at the Republican convention. Hillary Clinton took on everybody and brought them in and said, this is our country. We will work together. We will make it together. We will struggle together and make sure that we achieve all our aspirations. It was a speech that was such much of a stark contrast with Mr. Trump's speech, in that she wanted everybody to understand that no one person can do anything in this country. I am going to be your leader, but we're going to work together. She embraced people. She, in a way, was humble in accepting this nomination by saying, thank you for nominating me, but we're going to work together with all the organs, and I appreciate everybody else and all their efforts, because together, then we make things happen. Together, we make this country stronger. What a difference it was. What a contrast between the two.
Vincent, thank you very much again for joining us, and thank you very much for a very wonderful coverage of the two conventions, the Republican and Democratic Party convention. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's viewers Vincent Mankuri, who has been covering the U.S. Democratic Party convention in Philadelphia. Malawi and the World Food Program, or the WFP, have started distribution of relief food to people in 24 of the country's 28 districts worst hit by food shortages. Lamek Masina witnessed the official launch of the program and reports from Blantyre.
Traditional dance was one of the activities at the launch of the Malawi's largest ever humanitarian response This comes 3 months after findings of the Malawi Vulnerability Assessment Committee showed that 6.5 million people, nearly half of the Malawi's population, will require food assistance until the next harvest season. The committee attributed the food shortage situation to drought and the El Nino weather phenomenon, which affected this year's harvests. Malawi's Vice President Saulos Chilima presided over the launch. He told the gathering that the situation requires a quick response to save people's lives.
We are not rehearsing a response plan. It is not jokes. We have to work hard, smart, to avoid losing people's lives. The mistake we make here, somebody is going to lose their life.
Out of 6.5 million people who need food aid in Malawi, the WFP says it is targeting 5.8 million of them. The remaining 650,000 people will be supported by the government and other development partners. Gogo Ushiyama is country director for the WFP in Malawi. She says the distribution needs to be done quickly, especially in the flood-hit areas in southern Malawi.
This year, it's also La Niña. La Niña in this region is usually floods. So what we might see is that unless we pre-position a significant amount of food, especially in the south, before the rains come, we will be in trouble.
Nearly 90% of the households in need of food in Nsanje district have received aid. Malita Boniface is one of the beneficiaries. The mother of four children says she did not harvest anything from her 3 hectares maize garden because of the drought. Establish and feed under text. She says getting something to eat has been a big challenge. Sometimes we'd survive on water lily, and it becomes hard for children to eat it raw. Instead, we peel and mill it so that we can use its flour to cook porridge for children, she says. Food items the beneficiaries receive include sorghum, beans, and maize flour. Food distribution is expected to end March, the start of harvest season in Malawi. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Nsanje, Malawi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, July 29th. Daybreak Africa time, 18 minutes past the hour. The Ghana Journalists Association has expressed shock after the Supreme Court sentenced 3 people, including a radio host and 2 panelists, to 4 months in jail for contempt. 2 of those sentenced were sympathizers of the ruling party. They were accused of threatening to kill Supreme Court justices and inciting hatred against the judges during a live political program. David Agbenu, General Secretary of the Ghana Journalists Association, tells reporter Peter Clotty that President John Dramani Mahama has the constitutional power to pardon the jailed broadcasters despite opposition by some lawyers.
We have said that it's unfortunate, and we are really sad that it has come to this. The reason is that we did not expect that today we'll have journalists being incarcerated for free speech.
Does that mean the Ghana Journalists Association does not agree with the Supreme Court's ruling because the ruling undermines freedom of speech as guaranteed in the Ghanaian constitution?
Yes, in principle, do not disagree with the Supreme Court punishing them for contempt of court. But the level of punishment is what we are against. We think that it's severe and it's harsh.
But David Agbenu, some critics of the Ghana Journalists Association are saying that the defense of these gentlemen who basically were making their comments on the air was not strong enough. What do you say to that?
I completely disagree with those who hold that view. The reason is that this is a contempt of the Supreme Court, the highest court of the land. It's not an ordinary contempt that has been taken to court by, say, the Attorney General that will warrant us to mount a defense. Over there, their lawyers were just asked to plea, and then they proceeded to issue their verdict. What can the DDA do at that particular time? The DDA will be unable to do anything at that point. What we are saying is that we have fought for the freedom of the media and of the press, be led to the removal of the criminal libel law. We will be the last to sit and look at the erosion of the gains that we have made over the years. And we have said that so forcefully up to this point. What our colleagues have gone through is just unfortunate, and it's because of what I'll call foolhardiness, because the signs were there. They walked into a minefield, and that is where we are today.
Their supporters have called on President John Dramani Mahama to pardon them for the sake of freedom of speech, which is protected in the Constitution. What is your reaction to that?
What I'm hearing is that they are saying that the punishment is harsh and it's so lopsided. That's the argument. But I'm saying that the president has the power. It's the president's prerogative to pardon prisoners. Personally, I will not stand in the way of anybody who wants to punish those gentlemen. What we have to adhere to is rule of law.
David Agbenu is the General Secretary of the Ghana Journalist Association. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Accra. Human Rights Watch has called on the Senegalese government to do more to protect children known as Talibis who are forced by their Quranic teachers to beg for money in the streets. In a new report, the group noted that during the first half of 2016, at least five children living in residential Quranic schools died, allegedly as a result of beatings by their teachers, known as madabouts. The group welcomed the Senegalese government's recent decision to remove the Talibis from the streets. Lauren Seibert, author of the report, says her organization wants the government to sustain the momentum with investigations and prosecutions of the Quranic teachers and others who commit serious violations against children.
While we welcome this new initiative that Senegal has taken, they've been very proactive after the announcement from the president on June 30th that all street children should be removed from the streets. So they have been taking these kids off the streets, returning them to their parents. More than 300 so far have been swept up off the streets. However, we really think that while this is a laudable move, it needs to be sustained with increasing investigations and prosecutions for the Quranic teachers that do, in fact, exploit and abuse their Quranic students called Talibé, which is one of the reasons they end up on the streets in the first place. These children, many, many of them are forced to beg by some of these teachers, and they spend their days on the streets every day. And any abuses by these teachers, including several that we've documented in this report, often go unprosecuted. In this report, we outline a number of these cases of abuse and exploitation that we have documented, and we advise that laws must be passed to regulate these traditional Quranic schools, and current existing child protection law must be enforced to protect these children, in addition to the initiative that's already going on to take these kids off the streets.
If this has been going on, why do you think it's been allowed to go on?
This is a very deeply rooted cultural tradition in West Africa, not just in Senegal, but Senegal is probably the biggest manifestation in terms of sheer number of kids begging on the streets for their Quranic teachers. They go by different names in different West African countries, but in Senegal they're mostly called Talibé. And this, just for the past decade, the system has sort of changed and altered so that now in many cases there are Quranic teachers that sort of take advantage of the unregulated nature of these traditional Quranic schools to exploit the kids and to mistreat them. And because it's already a deeply embedded part of their culture for parents to send their children away to live and study under a Quranic teacher, it has been very hard to address the aspect of this system that's become an abusive aspect, especially considering how influential religious leaders are in Senegal in terms of in the political sphere and in communities throughout Senegal. So it's quite a complex issue, and we are not at all suggesting that the practice of sending children to Quranic schools needs to be stopped or changed. We are just simply saying that the schools should be regulated and adhere to international standards to protect children's rights to health, to education, to well-being. I mean, these kids are continually still being forced to beg, which is a form of exploitation, and they are being subject to being beaten, sometimes beaten to death. We've documented 4 cases of kids beaten to death and 3 just in 2016 by teachers using corporal punishment in these schools.
Are there any laws to regulate the Quranic schools?
That's currently another key issue with this system, as it is a traditional system of schooling that has never been subject to national regulation in Senegal.
That was Lawrence Seibert of Human Rights Watch. She was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Zimbabwean police have arrested Victor Matamadana, Secretary General of the Zimbabwe National Liberation War Veterans Association, which last week dumped President Robert Mugabe, referring to him as a national liability. Reporter Patricia Mudadigwa has more from Harare.
Matamadana's arrest follows that of Douglas Maia, Secretary for Information and Publicity of the Zimbabwe National Liberation War Veterans Association, who handed himself to the police after 13 men that identified themselves as police officers descended on his Chitungiza home and searched the premises. In a statement, the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights said it is not yet clear where the former freedom fighter is detained. Police were not reachable for comment. Matamadana may face the same charges like Mahia, who is accused of allegedly violating some provisions of the Criminal Law Codification and Reform Act. Mahia allegedly attempted to subvert a constitutionally elected government and is said to have insulted the office of the president. Matamadana and Mahia said to have convened a meeting of the war veterans last week, which issued a stinging communique blaming Zimbabwe's socio-economic and political problems on Mr. Mugabe. Mahia predicted his arrest last week.
The level of enmity from the government is the same level of enmity that we have received from Ian Smith, who on site had the right to shoot. What they cannot do is to shoot. But what you will witness after this meeting is a rampant arrests, persecution, and any other.
Political analyst Petsai Ruanya of the Zimbabwe Institute for Democracy told Studio 7 that Mr. Mugabe has always allegedly used force to crush dissenting voices. Ernest Mudzengi, another political analyst, echoed the same sentiments, saying there are no signs that Mr. Mugabe's government is upholding the rule of law in the country as stipulated in the new constitution.
ZANU-PF is not very sincere in terms of sticking to the rule of law. The law to them can only be applied if it is not a threat to ZANU-PF to hold on power. Most of the president Mugabe is to hold on power.
Clarice Maduku, a civil society activist and director of the Platform for Youth Development, also claimed that the president is using the police to scare people who want to stage peaceful protest on the deteriorating economic situation in the country. ZANU-PF spokesman Simon Kayamoyo was not reachable for comment. The war veterans who have been supporting the ruling party since independence say the ideals of the liberation struggles have been hijacked by President Mugabe and his inner circle. Their leader, Christopher Muchangwa, who is said to be backing Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa to succeed Mr. Mugabe, he has been expelled from ZANU-PF and government and recalled from parliament by the ruling party for allegedly undermining the authority of the president. Reporting from Harare, this is Patricia Mudadigwa.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The United Nations says it is suspending humanitarian assistance missions to Nigeria's Borno state pending a security review after an aid convoy was ambushed by unidentified attackers on Thursday in northern Nigeria. And that's it for this Friday, July 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Button, Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good weekend.
Next on Let's Talk, obsession in a relationship. What does it do? Help or hurt the relationship? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing obsession in a relationship. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.